Good morning, everyone. My name is Liza, and I'm going to read articles from the Daily Item. This is Thursday, February 19th. The first article I'm going to read, Saugus Plaza sign causes flood concerns. Fellsway Plaza at 655 Broadway was a topic of discussion at Wednesday night's Conservation Commission as it looks to put up a second sign on the Lynn Fells Parkway side close to Bennett's Brook. Craig Marchionda of Marchionda & Associates was there to speak with the commission. It wasn't the first time the project had been discussed. The commission raised several issues with it at the meeting. Before Chair Paul Petkovich spoke on the new issues, Marchionda mentioned the items they had already addressed from the meeting back in November. The commission asked for a few things, one being having the locations of the corners of each footing stake out the field, which did back in the beginning of December. We were also asked to show a proposal route for the electric trench on the plan, which we added as well, Marchionda noted. He continued that all trenching would be within the existing parking lot and that the electrical engineer tested the power and found it adequate. With the electric trench being shown, we also increased the length of our erosion control to protect that area, he said. Marchionda stated that they were limited in where they could put the sign and that they wanted it as close to the Fellsway as possible to be visible to those traveling east and west. This is a very quick project. Just putting the sign in and there's no long-term potential impacts, he said. Petkovich then raised his first concern. The sign was to be placed in an area marked as a fire lane. I can't speak for the fire department, but I'm almost certain this isn't a real fire lane, Marchionda said. I think someone put the signs there so no one parks there. There's fire lanes along the entire frontage of the whole building. Commission member Jennifer Dion asked that someone verify this information to ensure it was not a fire lane, and Petkovich agreed. My other main concern is that it's right on top of Bennett's Brook. So, a windstorm, a plow truck, anything that hits that, it's going right into the brook. I really can't see it happening at that location, Petkovich said. Marchionda said the sign was designed by a structural engineer and that it has footings and support. Petkovich also mentioned that there is a sign limitation in town stating that only one sign is allowed per strip mall. Abutter Jackie Kitty was there to oppose the project, stating that she agreed with the law that there should only be one sign per strip mall. However, she also raised environmental issues that could be caused. In your mission statement, it says preserving land and preserving the values and aesthetics. And one of the things I mentioned in my letter of opposition was the pollution, she said. Kitty brought up the light pollution that would be caused by the sign, noting that it would be shining right across the street from where she lives. I think it is intrusive. It's a negative impact upon the value of the property of the people that live there, Kitty said. Abutter Carl Wagner said his main concern was flooding, and Kitty agreed. The town has done substantial work over the past couple of years to help us, and it's worked. And I'd hate to see anything go against that, Wagner said. He stated that he meant no disrespect towards the engineering firm, but that he hadn't heard anything from them about what they are doing, and that it seems, with the first fire lane not being taken into consideration, among other things, that the firm didn't have concern for the residents. The sign holds no public value. It's not for public safety. It's not bringing anything to the neighborhood. It could have an impact on our water drainage system. We've flooded our basement. We've lost our basement. I just really want that to be taken into consideration, he said. Marchionda disagreed with the possibility of flooding, stating that the area would lose a small amount of volume for storing water. We're talking about less than 900 gallons, approximately, due to the volume of these footings, he said. The discussion will continue at the March meeting. with Marchionda stating that he will check with the fire department about the fire lanes. And that is the end of that article. This next article, Lynn and Lynn Field still at odds over wetlands. During Tuesday's meeting of the Lynn Conservation Commission, Chairman Mike Toomey once again stepped aside from his official role to speak as a concerned citizen about ongoing issues stemming from the town of Linfield's work near Judge Road. The area, which borders the Nell's Pond Cedar Creek wetlands, has been the focus of an enforcement order under the Massachusetts Wetlands Protection Act. Toomey detailed the ongoing environmental impact, saying, "This has been going on for almost 2.5 years. I've been on this commission for 25-plus years, and I've never had a violator basically just ignore everything that has gone on." He criticized Linfield officials for failing to follow through on commitments to correct the damage, noting, "The representatives of the town of Linfield have made commitments that they were going to move forward, and they just haven't done anything at all in regard to the enforcement order." The chairman highlighted the potential public health risk, saying, "The concern is that spring rains would bring flooding, and the flooding now, because of the actions of the town of Linfield, is going to bring polluted water that's loaded with human waste into an area and land that never had that problem. I'm concerned about the possibility of having to deal with that in my own neighborhood." Toomey also raised concerns about the structural impacts of the breach in drainage control, explaining, "They've made the breach. Now it's about 2.5 feet wide, and the pipe has dropped out. And all of that stuff is now going into Lynn, where it did not go out before. It shouldn't be getting flooded at all." In addition, he questioned the commission's legal strategy, suggesting, "I would like to ask the commission to consider hiring an attorney skilled in wetlands issues to represent the commission, as the enforcement is totally ignored by the town." Toomey emphasized the importance of acting promptly, adding, "I think that if we continue to play this softball game, they're not going to actually remedy that. Ultimately, that's what I'm looking for, not necessarily the payout, but for them to remediate the situation." He concluded by requesting the commission continue the public hearing until a follow-up meeting with Linfield officials could be scheduled, and asked that he be allowed to attend as a resident. The Conservation Commission continues to push forward with enforcement actions against Linfield, though attempts to schedule meetings with town officials have repeatedly been delayed. And that's the end of that particular article. This next article, Zuckerberg answers to social media criticisms. L.A. Mark Zuckerberg and opposing lawyers dueled in a Los Angeles courtroom on Wednesday, where the Meta CEO answered questions about young people's use of Instagram, his congressional testimony and internal advice he's received about being authentic and not robotic. Zuckerberg's testimony is part of an unprecedented social media trial that questions whether Meta's platforms deliberately addict and harm children. During questioning by the plaintiff's lawyer, Zuckerberg said he still agrees with a previous statement he made that the existing body of scientific work has not proven that social media causes mental health harms. The plaintiff's attorney, Mark Lanier, asked Zuckerberg if people tend to use something more if it's addictive. "I'm not sure what to say to that," Zuckerberg said. "I don't think that applies here." Attorneys representing the plaintiff, a now 20-year-old woman identified by the initials KMG, claimed her early use of social media addicted her to the technology and exacerbated depression and suicidal thoughts. Meta Platforms and Google's YouTube are the two remaining defendants in the case, which TikTok and Snap have settled. Beginning his questioning, Lanier laid out three options of what people can do regarding vulnerable people. Help them, ignore them, or prey upon them and use them for our own ends. Zuckerberg said he agrees the last option is not what a reasonable company should do, saying, "I think a reasonable company should try to help the people that use its services." Lania questioned the Meadow CEO extensively about a comment he made during the past congressional hearing, where he said Instagram employees are not given goals to increase amount of time people spent on the platform. Lania presented internal documents that seemed to contradict that statement. Zuckerberg replied that they previously had goals associated with time, but he said the company made the conscious decision to move away from those goals, focusing instead on utility. He said he believes in the basic assumption that if something is valuable, people will use it more because it's useful to them. Lania also asked Zuckerberg about what he characterized as extensive media training, including for testimonies like the one he was giving in court. Lania pointed to an internal document about feedback on Zuckerberg's tone of voice in his own social media, imploring him to come off as authentic, direct, human, insightful, and real, and instructing him to not try hard, fake, robotic, corporate, or cheesy in his communication. Zuckerberg pushed back against the idea that he's been coached on how to respond to questions or present himself, saying those offering the advice were just giving feedback. Regarding his media appearances and public speaking, Zuckerberg said, "I think I'm actually well known to be sort of bad at this." The Meta CEO has long been mocked online for appearing robotic and, when he was younger, nervous when speaking. In 2010, during an interview with renowned tech journalist Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg, he was sweating so profusely that Swisher asked him if he wanted to take off the hoodie that was his uniform at the time. Lania spent a considerable stretch of his time with Zuckerberg asking about the company's age verification policies. Excuse me. "I don't see why it is so complicated," Zuckerberg said after a lengthy back and forth, reiterating that the company's policy restricts users under the age of 13 and that they work to detect users who have lied about their ages to bypass restrictions. Zuckerberg mostly stuck to his talking points, referencing his goal to build a platform that is valuable to users, and on multiple occasions saying he disagreed with Lanier's characterization of his questions or of Zuckerberg's own comments. As was the case with head of Instagram Adam Mosseri's testimony last week, Zuckerberg was grilled about policies relating to cosmetic beauty filters on Instagram. Zuckerberg said he didn't believe there was enough evidence pointing to harm the filters could cause and said he has a high bar for blocking tools to external experts Meta hired to assess the filters and their potential impacts, saying that all 18 of them raised concerns. Children's advocates slammed Zuckerberg's testimony as disingenuous. All Mark Zuckerberg accomplished with his testimony today was to prove yet again that he cannot be trusted, especially when it comes to kids' safety, said Josh Golem, executive director of Fair Play. Under oath, Meta's CEO testified that his company does not have an objective to increase users' time spent on Instagram. But we know Zuckerberg and his fellow executives prevented Instagram from getting rid of features like visible like counts and plastic surgery filters, features that are by their very nature addictive. Zuckerberg has testified in other trials and answered questions from Congress about youth safety on Meta's platforms. During his 2024 congressional testimony, he apologized to families whose lives had been upended by tragedies they believed were caused by social media. But while he told parents he was sorry for everything you have been through, he stopped short of taking direct responsibility for it. This trial marks the first time Zuckerberg stands before a jury. Once again, bereaved parents are sitting in the courtroom audience. The case, along with two others, has been selected as a bellwether trial, meaning its outcome could impact how thousands of similar lawsuits against social media companies are likely to play out. One of Meta's attorneys, Paul Schmidt, said in his opening statement that the company is not disputing that KMG experienced mental health struggles, but rather disputing that Instagram played a substantial factor in those struggles. He pointed to medical records that showed a turbulent home life, and both he and an attorney representing YouTube argue she turned to the platforms as a coping mechanism or a means of escaping her mental health struggles. Mehta is also facing a separate trial in New Mexico that began last week. And that is the end of that particular article. Okay, this next article, judge rules on GAR theft. Lynn. On Tuesday evening at the Grand Army of the Republic, GAR, trustee meeting, board member Vincent Damore provided an update on two pending criminal cases, stemming from the May 2025 break-in at the GAR Museum, including a restitution dispute that could now move toward appeal. Damore said he and the museum curator, Wendy Joseph, attended a restitution hearing approximately 2 weeks ago in Lynn District Court. Although Ashley Moutre, who was involved in the break-in with Zachary Bridges, was not present in court for the hearing, the parties were informed that she did not plan to contest the restitution amount. Instead, she was expected to request a Henry hearing, a proceeding used to assess a defendant's ability to pay. Damore said he and Joseph provided the court with the requested information and left with the understanding that the matter would proceed the following week. However, he later received a call from the prosecutor assigned to the case with unexpected news. According to Damore, the court, without a formal motion before it, determined that Moutre had no ability to pay and entered an order setting restitution at $0. In my view, at least, it's an unlawful order, Damore said, adding that he expects to hear from the prosecutor by the end of the week regarding possible next steps, including whether the decision will be appealed. Damore emphasized that the dispute is not about the $100 restitution amount at issue. This is not about the money, he said. I certainly spent far more of my own time sitting in court on this. I probably could have written a check 2 months ago. But there is a principle behind it that I think is important that we continue to enforce. He said he will continue working with the district attorney's office to ensure the matter proceeds appropriately. Separately, Damore said Bridges' case remained pending with no substantive updates at this time. And that's the end of that particular article. Okay, this next article, advocates cry foul on Healey cuts to DCR budget. A public parks nonprofit is raising concerns about cuts proposed for two conservation and recreation accounts in Governor Maury Healey's fiscal 2027 budget recommendation. Healey's $63 billion budget proposal would increase overall spending by 3.8% over the budget she signed for fiscal 2026. The proposal would cut the Department of Conservation and Recreation State Parks operation account by 8.3% and its seasonal employee count by 2.9%, according to Mass Parks for All Executive Director Doug Pizzi. DCR funds most of its day-to-day functions from the operations account, while the seasonal account pays to staff our forests, parks, campgrounds, beaches, pools, and other DCR facilities during peak use periods, primarily during the summer months, Pizzi wrote in a blog post. These accounts put people in the parks and put boots on the ground, Pizzi told News Services. Healey's proposal recommends about $104.38 million for state parks operations in fiscal 2027, compared to fiscal 26 allocating $113.8 million. She proposed about $82.46 million for DCR seasonals in fiscal 27, compared to about $29.2 million allocated in fiscal 26 budget. The public lands nonprofit is seeking a 3.5% increase in both accounts over fiscal 26 allocations and requesting that the legislature do so by reducing by $15.32 million the $100 million that is expected to flow into the state's stabilization fund. DCR did not respond to a News Service inquiry about the funding decrease in time for publication. In a fiscal 2027 budget brief, the Healey administration wrote that its proposal ensures that the Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Conservation and Recreation are staffed to continue providing core services to the Commonwealth, outlining a $101 million investment for state parks and recreation, DCR seasonals, and administration at DCR, which keeps our parks, forests, beaches, trails, rinks, pools, and campgrounds open, safe, and accessible to the public. From an economic perspective, Peasy wrote, it makes no sense to us to shortchange a vital economic engine still not fully recovered from more than a decade of woeful underfunding during and after the 2008 recession. DCR contributes mightily to the state's $16 billion annual outdoor economy, $13 billion in consumer spending, and another $3.0 billion in worker wages. It is currently the fastest growing outdoor economy in the nation. We want to see that growth continue, he added. And that's the end of that article. Okay, it's the next article. Office to housing conversions aim to bring vitality and energy to the streets. LG talks up Pittfield's housing-forward culture. About 340 new housing units will be created in Boston, Fitchburg, New Bedford, Pittsfield, and Worcester through the transformation of former commercial properties, the governor said. Speaking inside a former bank building in downtown Pittsfield, Governor Maury Healey announced Tuesday the first tranche of funding awards, nearly $8.4 million from the Commercial Conversion Tax Credit Initiative. Launched through 2024's $5 billion housing policy and borrowing law, the initiative is designed to support projects that turn underused or vacant office buildings into new housing units as the Healey administration aims to speed up housing production and close the state's estimated 220,000 unit deficit. The funding stream can also help rejuvenate downtown and commercial areas by refurbishing blighted properties, officials said. It looks like this is going to move really quickly, and in no short time you're going to see 23 modern safe housing units along with street-level retail and a commercial kitchen right here in this space, Healey said, referring to the Pittsfield building that was awarded about $1.4 million in CCTCI credits. It's a win for housing access. It's a win for economic development. It's a win for the city of Pittsfield, the governor continued. Representative Tricia Farley Bouvier of Pittsfield, Leigh Davis of Great Barrington, Tara Hong of Lowell, and Rodney Elliott of Lowell joined Healey's Western Mass press conference. In addition to Pittsfield, the Healey administration gave $3.6 million in office conversion tax credits to an historic office building in downtown Worcester that's being redeveloped into 198 homes and $1.1 million to a former New Bedford nursing home that will be revamped into 65 homes. Officials also awarded $970,000 in tax credits to an historic office building in Boston's financial district that will become 18 homes, and $1.3 million for an historic office building in downtown Fitchburg that will be turned into 35 homes. These projects are backed by a blend of other financing, including historic tax credits and support from the Housing Development Incentive Program. Housing and Livable Communities Secretary Ed Augustus framed housing as an economic development strategy as he highlighted the new foot traffic he hopes will soon come to Pittsfield due to the office conversion. You're going to take a building that has been empty for a number of years. You're going to turn it into your housing and some commercial space, Augustus said. And the people who live here are going to go across the street to the Beacon Cinema and see a movie. And then they're going to have something to eat or grab a coffee after, or walk and support the shops and the restaurants, and bringing back vitality and energy to the streets. Gateway cities like Pittsfield were historically affordable communities, but now residents are being priced out, Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll said. She said the state's housing programs hinge on collaboration with local officials. And that's the end of that particular article. This next article from the opinion page, helping Massachusetts families keep the heat on. This is a letter to the editor. A single mother who was having trouble juggling work and affordable child care, a household having a hard time dealing with the high prices for essential items like food and rent, a father who recently lost his job. For many Massachusetts families in temporary crisis, possibly in your own community, lower temperatures have them facing another cold reality, not being able to pay the monthly energy bill. The Massachusetts Good Neighbor Energy Fund, sponsored by 18 energy service providers in the state and administered by the Salvation Army, is often the last resort for families who are in need of a helping hand and who have not qualified for federal and state assistance programs. Unfortunately, we expect the urgency of need to continue to escalate throughout the rest of the winter and into the spring. With this in mind, those in need of energy assistance should visit their local Salvation Army Service Center or call 800-262-1320 if they live in the area code 413, or 800-334-3047 if they live in the area codes 339-351-508-617-774-781-857-978. To help us satisfy the more than 1,500 requests for aid anticipated this winter and spring alone, we appeal to everyone in the Massachusetts area to join their fellow residents and the Commonwealth and the fund sponsoring energy companies to give the gift of warmth. People can donate by using the Green Goods Neighbor Energy Fund donation envelopes found as an insert in their monthly utility bills, scanning the QR code featured on the donation envelope, or through the Add a Dollar program some energy companies offer. Residents can also donate with a credit card by visiting magoodneighbor.org or by simply writing a check payable to the Good Neighbor Energy Fund. On behalf of all the families in need, thank you. And that is the end of the reading for this article, the Lynn Daily. Have a good day.